at him. And sometimes when you act based on knowledge, obviously it should make a difference. So the hadith, he says, من عمل على غير علم, when someone works and does things without knowing. Now that's a problem. Because what happens is, he said, yufsid, what you would corrupt, what you would break, more than that you could mend and fix and rectify. And therefore, we have to be very careful that to understand our amal, our knowledge, it needs to be practical and useful. Otherwise, we will put ourselves in trouble. Look at this hadith. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, إن أهل النار ليتأذون من ريح العالم التارك لعلمه. The people of hellfire, they themselves, they get hurt and annoyed by the scholar who is thrown in hellfire. Why? Because he did not apply his knowledge. Now, I don't know, but that seems to me that these scholars, they have more punishment than sinners themselves. So we have to be very, very careful when it comes to ulama. Ilm itself requires amal, requires practice, requires applying. To sit and give theories is very easy. For me to just to sit around and teach people and preach to people is quite easy. But when I'm not applying it, is a problem. That in the dunya, in this world, I might be able to get away with it. But in the hereafter, it's going to be a problem. I can't escape the consequences of my actions in this world. Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salam, he says, لا يستوي عند الله في العقوبة الذين يعملون والذين لا يعلمون. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not, in the sight of Allah, those who know and those who do not know, is they not equal in the sight of Allah? Obviously, there's a difference. نَفَعَنَ اللَّهُ وَإِيَّاكُمْ بِمَا عَلَّمَنَا. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increases our knowledge in whatever He has given us. وَجَعَلَهُ لِوَجْهِهِ خَالِصًا. And may Allah make this sincerely just for His sake. إِنَّهُ سَمِيعٌ مُجِيبٌ. This is the dua of Amir al-Mu'mineen. After saying that, when it comes to punishment, that those who know and those who don't would differ. So sometimes those who know get more punishment than those who don't. Because those who don't, they just don't. They will get a punishment, but much less than those who know but never applied. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Omali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که این رو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Oh, 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 oh. Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. We said that the punishment between the scholars and non-scholars are different. Scholars will get more punishment. And one might wonder, why would the scholar get more punishment than someone who is not a scholar? Who are in the same, you know, because we said if they're both in hell, those who are in hell will be complaining about the odor and the evil and bad punishment of the alim that is with them in hell. The Prophet, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he says, Zallatul alimi kankisar as-safina. When a scholar, a knowledgeable person, slips and makes a mistake, what happens? He says, in the same way when a ship breaks down. What happens when the ship, if the ship is sailing in the middle of the ocean and breaks down? What happens is the ship itself will sink, and whoever is on board of that ship will sink too with it. No question about that. A'alim is that ship. The scholar is that ship. Once the scholar himself sinks, he will take with him all those who've been following him, listening to him. That's where the problem lies. So if we have a scholar, if we have a marja, for example, who has thousands and hundreds of thousands, millions of people following him, and this person, at some stage of his life, he becomes corrupted ideologically. He changes his mind regarding things, regarding the Ahl Bayt, regarding the Quran, regarding the Hadith. I don't know. He changes, and he keeps coming up with new theories and new ideas, and he uses his scholarly way in trying to convince people that what he's saying is true. And maybe a lot of people, a lot of youth, will fall for that. Now, he has broken. What he did, he took everyone with him. He drowned, and he drowned everyone with him. Therefore, the punishment would be much more severe. It is stated that a story in Benu Israel, it said that one day a person claimed to be a prophet, and he preached his prophethood, and people accepted him. And they said, you know what? Whatever you say makes a lot of sense. And after a while, he started getting more supporters and more people following him. And, you know, he became viral, as we say. After a while, this man sat down with himself, and he realized what he did was a grave, grave sin. That he's claiming to be a prophet of Allah, inviting people to a new religion, and what have you. So he felt very scared. So he repented. And then he went to one of the prophets of his time. He said to him, look, this is what I've done, and I want Allah to forgive me. This prophet speaks to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and Allah tells him, listen, tell this person, I will forgive him under one condition. And that is, he has to go back and convince everyone that believed in him that what he did was wrong and he's not a true prophet. And then they have to go back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If that happens, then I will forgive him. That's why scholars, they are like a ship in the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. If it breaks, it will drown and will drown everyone with it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Mandop Street.
Part 1.
This is the Baba Mandab Strait, the Gate of Tears, and one of the most vital maritime channels in the world.
Most cargo operators now won't send their boats through the strait connecting the Red Sea with the Gulf of Aden. That's known as the Gates of Grief.
12% of the world's maritime trade is carried out through the Suez Canal, and all ships passing through this canal must pass through the Bab el-Mandab Strait, an area that has become the scene of a major international naval battle over the past year. It all started with the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the beginning of the brutal Israeli aggression on Gaza. And since that date on, every week the world heard news of Israeli ships or their Western supporters being targeted in the north and south of the Bab el-Mandab Strait. Shipping companies that were in contact with the Zionist regime had two choices: to reroute around the southern tip of the African continent and make the route longer, or to accept the risk of the Ansarallah missile attacks or even the seizure of their ships in retaliation for the widespread support of Western countries for the Zionist regime's aggression against the Gaza Strip.
To put that in perspective, 90% of the world's goods, or somewhere between 70% and 90% of all the world's goods, are transported
by ship.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 10 to 12% of that entire global effort is transiting through the Red Sea in this narrow strait.
8% of LNG, I think like 8% of grain, and I think 12% of oil. LNG actually stopped completely going through there. We haven't had an LNG ship go through since, I believe, January of this year. But the first one had a successful transit last week.
The Bab el-Mandab Strait is a major transit route between the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe, with about 15% of global maritime trade and 30% of the world's container traffic passing through it. As of November 2023, 500,000 containers pass through the Bab el-Mandab Strait daily.
So, Tad, the Bab el-Mandab is actually Suez Canal.
Right.
If you're going to go through the Suez Canal, you're going to go through the Bab el-Mandab. But it's absolutely important. It's one of the three key choke points in the Central Command region: the Suez Canal, the Bab el-Mandab, and, of course, the Strait of Hormuz.
Any disruption to maritime security in the Bab el-Mandab Strait would put a huge strain on major global shipping companies and consequently on global maritime trade. If commercial ships were to be cut off from the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the alternative route would be to circumnavigate the African continent and pass through the Cape of Good Hope in the south of the continent, which would lengthen the route by about 3,500 nautical miles and increase the time it takes to transport goods by sea from origin to destination by an average of 10 days, which would increase the ship's fuel consumption by 33%.
Yes, certainly. Well, this is all about the Suez Canal. That Red Sea is the entrance to that, and that's what the commercial shippers now are, obviously, if they're not going through there, going all the way around Africa, and that's going to impact global economy.
A few years ago, this problem occurred on a smaller scale in another maritime passage. On March 23, 2011, the Suez Canal was closed for a week until March 29th due to the grounding of the container ship, the Ever Given, which left 15 ships at harbor and at least 237 ships waiting to pass through the canal, resulting in the freezing of trade worth over $9 billion a day. Land routes can never be a substitute for for strategic passages such as the Bab el-Mandab Strait or the Suez Canal because of limitations such as the volume of goods carried, border and customs problems, and the presence of a large number of countries along the route. These cases show the importance of the Gulf of Aden, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Red Sea for global trade, and the slightest incident affects the entire world and directly or indirectly involves many countries.
It's important to differentiate between what's happening between Israel and Hamas and what's happening in the Red Sea.
Given the high importance of the Bab el-Mandab Strait in global maritime trade for several decades, the world's major powers and countries on the strait's periphery have been trying to gain military dominance over this strategic waterway and have spent relatively large budgets to establish permanent or temporary military bases in this area.
We're witnessing one of the largest shifts in global geostrategic power that the world is witnessing.
Among foreign countries competing in the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the United Arab Emirates has made great effort to expand its military operations in countries that surround the strait. The most important bases of the UAE's army include the island of Socotra and several naval bases in the port cities of Aden and Mocha in southern Yemen, two military bases in Somalia, and one base in Eritrea and Djibouti, and efforts to establish a presence on the coast of Sudan. The Emiratis made great efforts to achieve complete military dominance over this strategic waterway by dominating the ports of southern Yemen and the islands of Socotra and Mayoun. However, Ansarullah's resistance and heavy attacks on UAE interests in this area have prevented Abu Dhabi from fully realizing this goal. Abu Dhabi's partner, and in some cases, long-standing rival in this regard, is Saudi Arabia, which has been developing its naval fleet centered on the port of Jeddah for several years due to its long coastline on the Red Sea, and on the other hand, it also has military presence in Djibouti alongside some regional and supra-regional powers. For the Saudi rulers, dominating the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab was a way to escape the geopolitical deadlock and excessive dependence on the Strait of Hormuz, but to this day, they have not succeeded in doing so, and all three of their maritime access routes, namely the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Suez Canal, are controlled by their rival powers. Turkey, which has been pursuing its strategic development plans from the Caucasus to North Africa since Erdogan's rule, is one of the new powers that has been trying to establish an active military presence in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandab Strait in recent years. The Turkish army currently has military bases in Somalia and Sudan. Several European countries, including Britain, France, and Spain, have also increased their activities in the Red Sea region over the past decade, centered on the French military base in Djibouti. Over time, other European Union countries have also joined the French base, as 70% of the EU's imports pass through the Red Sea.
Djibouti is very important. We use it, as you noted, as a base. Mm-hmm. Others, friends and others, use it as a base as well. Mm-hmm. It's important because we also base other kinds of maritime reconnaissance aircraft there.
Djibouti's strategic location in the Horn of Africa has led two East Asian players to establish military bases in the country. One of these two countries is Japan, which has been establishing a permanent military base in Djibouti since 2011. This is the first military base away from home
that Japan has established since the Second World War. With China's increasing power in global trade and the rapid development of its naval fleet, the Chinese also established their base in Djibouti in 2016. Thanks to its heavy investment in the African continent and to protect its commercial interests, especially based on the One Belt, One Road mega project, China has a great need to maintain the security of the Red Sea region, and this requires a permanent military presence, especially a port capable of receiving heavy naval vessels of the country's navy. Although the Zionist regime has a very narrow coastline in the Gulf of Aqaba on the way to the Red Sea, in the past decades, they've tried to expand their strategic depth of access to the sea from the southern part of the occupied territories by expanding their military and security presence on the islands of the southern Red Sea, such as Dahlak and Perim, as well as a secret spy and telecommunications interception base at Mount Embo Soira in the Eritrean territory.
The Houthis have achieved something, if nothing more than they've caused everyone to recognize the fact that they can, in fact, impact a very strategic area with almost nothing.
The Zionists have long sought to control the Mediterranean Red Sea maritime trade route in order to secure common interests with Western countries. The big Suez Canal crisis in 1956, with the joint attack of Israel, France, and Britain to regain control of the canal, and the big Yom Kippur War of 1973 with the Egyptian and Syrian armies, were among the important steps taken by the Zionist regime in this direction. Finally, the largest military presence among foreign countries, as expected, is that of the United States, which, thanks to its largest military base in Djibouti and the pretext of fighting Somali pirates, has deployed a large number of its vessels at sea and its aircraft and combat forces in African countries bordering the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden for two decades.
The Houthis shut down maritime traffic in the Red Sea. The United States declares Operation Prosperity Guardian. We're going, United States is going, we got a carrier task force, we got destroyers, we got cruisers, we got NATO partners. By God, Houthis, watch out now. Here we come. And what happened? Carrier task force group is pulled out. Yeah, still got some destroyers there. And who has shut down the Red Sea? The Houthis. Can't stop the Houthis.
But despite the fierce competition between various world powers for military presence in the countries of the Horn of Africa and the outskirts of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, without dominating the coasts of Yemen or at least establishing a partnership with the ruling power in this country and ensuring the security of the sea route north and south of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, all the aforementioned efforts for military presence in the Red Sea will almost be fruitless. This bitter truth was well understood by Western countries, and especially the Zionist entity, in the events that occurred over the past year.
They said explicitly and repeatedly that that was in defense of the Palestinian people who were being attacked by Israel.
The Yemeni people have been under colonial rule and domination by powers such as the Ottomans, Britain, the Soviet Union, the United States, and Saudi Arabia for over 100 years. But thanks to the emergence of the Ansarullah movement and its control over the capital and the western coasts of Yemen, it is now the will and decision of the Yemenis that determines safe passage through the Bab el-Mandab Strait. Any country whose actions are against the interests of the Yemeni people and the member states of the Axis of Resistance will not be allowed to safely transit its ships through the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab Strait.
When it comes to the Houthis, yes, they have ballistic missiles, And that is a significant capability.
On October 7th, 2023, the Palestinian Resistance Movement carried out Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, inflicting the greatest military security shock on the Zionist entity since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. The extremely high volume of Israeli casualties and captives transferred to the Gaza Strip had devastating effects on the Zionist regime militarily and socially. The Zionists carried out brutal bombing and major crimes against the oppressed Palestinian people in a different way than in previous battles, and this caused other resistance groups in the region to come to the aid of the Palestinian fighters in the Gaza Strip. Despite the distance of more than 1,800 kilometers to the occupied territories, the Yemeni army and popular forces demonstrated a very active and uninterrupted participation in supporting the Palestinian cause and the resistance. Given their access to the West Coast and very convenient access to the center and south of the Red Sea, the Yemeni Ansarullah had the ability to attack the south of occupied territories while at the same time having a relatively large arsenal of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and suicide drones, and played a special role in pressuring the Zionist regime. The first attacks by the Yemeni Ansarullah movement began on October 19, 2023, which was a combined attack with cruise missiles, attacks on ground targets, and suicide drones. Without U.S. military assistance, the Israeli military was unable to cover the south of the occupied territories because it was simultaneously busy attacking the Gaza Strip and fighting with the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah on the northern front.
I think it's really quite shameful that the administration is likely waiting until soldiers or sailors get killed in this. I mean, the idea of having a military is to deter. And when your adversary is escalating, then you have to take action to deter them from further escalation. And that is what we have failed to do here.
Therefore, from the very beginning of the Yemeni army's attacks on the port of Eilat, the U.S. Navy took direct action to defend the Zionist regime, for instance, claiming it had shot down 4 cruise missiles and 15 Yemeni drones on the same day. However, the volume of Yemeni army attacks on the south of the occupied territories and commercial ships affiliated with the Zionist entity in the Red Sea gradually increased, and the Americans were no longer able to counter these attacks alone. On December 18, 2023, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the formation of an international naval coalition to counter the Ansarullah's attacks, dubbed Operation Prosperity Guardian.
Regarding the Houthis, these attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law. And so we're taking action to build an international coalition to address this threat.
The coalition was formed with more than 20 members, but only the United States, the UK, Germany, Denmark, and Sri Lanka had warships in the conflict zone.
It's clear that this type of behavior can't be met without a response. We need to send a strong signal that this breach of international law is wrong. People can't act like this with impunity, and that's why, together with allies, we've decided to take this action.
The European countries of France, Italy, and Spain, along with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, refused to join the coalition and announced that they will independently escort commercial ships and counter Ansarullah missile and drone attacks. Also, according to many security and media sources, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have helped the Zionist regime to initially detect missiles and drones fired from Yemen into occupied territories, and even in some cases, intercepted and destroyed them. January of 2024, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2722 condemning the Ansarullah attacks in the Red Sea. Although one of the main points of this resolution was the efforts of all parties to the conflict to reduce the level of tension in the region, the United States and Britain abused the resolution and launched illegal airstrikes on Yemeni territory.
The U.S. says tonight that it is not interested in a war with Yemen, just hours after American and British missiles hit Houthi rebel positions there.
Massive naval and air campaign against the Yemeni army, an army that had been engaged in internal conflict with the Saudi and Emirati armies and their mercenaries for years, and now it was ready to fight a coalition with a strong leadership that had never been defeated in international waters. Although many countries were trying to escort ships and ensure their safety as they passed through the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the sum of all their assets combined was not as much as that of the United States. The U.S. Navy has at various times deployed two aircraft carrier groups with maximum possible operational capacity in the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea, the aircraft carrier the Eisenhower, and the amphibious assault ship the Bataan. Each of these two groups also included several destroyers, support ships, and nuclear submarines, the most famous of which were the destroyers the Mason, the Carney, and Laboon of the Arleigh Burke class, which recorded the most experience of engaging with missiles and drones fired from Yemen. The U.S. aircraft carriers are equipped with advanced F-35, F-18, and Harrier, as well as Poseidon Maritime Patrol and E-2 Hawkeye aircraft.
So what I saw there, you know, during my time as the Maritime Operations Center Director, the Houthis are not launching these one at a time. They're launching them in swarms. And then shortly behind the UAV would be a cruise missile. Or a ballistic missile, and I call them ballistic missiles, but we have to understand what's happening in the theater. They're not flying a ballistic trajectory. They're not going exo-atmospheric. Mm. It's the speed associated with it, but the Houthis have depressed the trajectory, and these missiles are getting out to the battle space fairly quickly. If a ballistic missile is fired from the typical launching points that we've seen, the ships have anywhere from 15 to 20 seconds.
While each escort destroyer carries more than 100 defensive missiles to counter attacks by the Yemeni army or Tomahawk cruise missiles to attack deep inside Yemeni territory, dozens of MQ-9 Reaper drones also conduct reconnaissance flights from nearby bases over Yemeni territory or Red Sea waters. According to the direct admission of the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. naval forces in the region, the U.S. Navy has never experienced such a combat formation for such a long time since World War II.
How many sailors are now in the Red Sea?
Yeah, we've got about 7,000 right now. So it's a large commitment.
When was the last time that the U.S. Navy operated at this pace for a couple months?
I think you'd have to go back to World War II, where you have ships who are engaged in combat. When I say engaged in combat, where they're getting shot at, we're getting shot at, and we're shooting back.
This is while large numbers of ships from European countries and the Royal Air Force's Eurofighter Typhoon fighter jets are also engaged in escorting commercial ships and carrying out attacks on Yemeni territory.
The Houthis are the first entity in the history of the world to use anti-ship ballistic missiles ever firing against shipping.
No one has ever used
an anti-ship ballistic missile, certainly against commercial shipping, much less against U.S. Navy ships. If there is an anti-ship ballistic missile launch, this ballistic missile travels at about Mach 5, about 3,000 miles an hour.
How much time is there between a Houthi launch and then it could reach a U.S. ship?
If it's coming toward them, now just put yourself in the seat of the destroyer captain on that ship. He has about 9 to 15 seconds to make a decision that they're going to shoot that down. it's intense.
The U.S. military has also made extensive use of its military bases in West Asia to direct attacks against Yemen.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to the program Month of Allah. We were talking about brotherhood and the fact that we have other obligations, not only limiting ourselves to just spirituality, only limiting ourselves to our obligation towards God. We also have obligations to the creation of God. If a person only focuses on one part of spirituality or one part of religion, it can be like a person that has, for example, a caricature of a person that has a very big ear or, say, a very big nose, meaning they have only focused on one part of their deen and one part of their religion. For us to be complete, it is very important for us to make sure that all parts of our religion and all dimensions of our religion are complete. And of those parts is brotherhood, that we should be very careful with the obligations that we have towards our fellow brothers. We should be very careful of the unity that we have, and we should always preserve unity amongst the Muslims. No matter what sect they are, no matter what part of the world they are from, we should solidify ourselves. And we all have one cause, and our cause is, inshallah, for us to reach God Almighty. It's important for us to know that the Imams, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, they can be displeased with us with the way that we disrespect our brothers, the way that we treat our fellow brothers. In a narration, it says that a group of people, they came to the 8th Imam, Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, alayhi salam. And for a period of time, they were waiting to see him. But the Imam did not want to see them. And then when they finally met him, they asked him, "How come you don't allow us to see you? How come you didn't allow us to see you?" And there the Imam told him that basically it is because of these following reasons. One, it is because you proclaim to be Shia, true Shia. But obviously they were not Shias. They were lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, but they were not at the level for them to even call themselves as true Shias. Other is the obligations they had towards Allah, that they were sinning. And one of the other reasons, and this is what I wanted to show you, brothers and sisters, is that the Imam alayhi salam tells him that you watataha wa nuna bi'adhima huquq ikhwanikum fillah, that you neglected the great rights of your brothers that they had in God's eyes. That you neglected their rights. So we will be liable in the Day of Judgment that we can be in a way that our imams are discouraged from our actions if we are not careful about our fellow brothers. But now a question I have is this, is should we treat all brothers in our community? Should we sacrifice our time and effort for all of them? Should we become friends with anybody that's in the masjid or in the mosque or the Islamic center? Well, for us to answer this question, we have to look at the narrations. The narrations give us a guideline about how to choose our friends. We should be very particular. A lot of times we allow our friends to choose us. When we look at these narrations, we should have the ability to choose our own friends. So what are some of the criteria for us to have true friends that we are going to be able to sacrifice for them, that we're going to give them our time and money? One of those characteristics that they should have is when we look at from one of the traditions from Imam Ali alayhi salam, says your true brother is the one who forgives your lapse. If you find a brother that he forgives, sometimes you might become angry and you say, I'm sorry. Your brother should be able to forgive your lapse. He fulfills your need. If you have a need, you need help, he comes and helps you. He accepts your excuse. If you explain to him why you behaved in this manner, he will accept it. He hides your vices. He doesn't zoom in into your faults. And he removes your fear and lives up to your aspiration. In another tradition we have from Imam Ali alayhi salam, a real brother is, he says, your brother is the one who does not abandon you in difficulty. Many people, when we test them, when we need them the most, we realize that they don't want to help us anymore. Test them to see when you have difficulty, will they come to your help? He does not forget you at the time of trouble and does not cheat you when you seek his advice. So these are the characteristics that a true brother should have. And these are brothers that we should be, that they deserve our help and they deserve our time. And these are people that we should connect with and we should spend our time with. So in this month of Ramadan, we inshallah will be getting closer to our own community. And inshallah we'll be choosing good brothers for ourselves that have these criteria.
قال الإمام الصادق عليه السلام عليك بالدعاء فإن فيه شفاء من كل داء.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, I urge you to supplicate, for verily in supplication is a cure for every ailment.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa.
Since Israel's invasion of Palestine and the occupation of the Jordan River cities, many religious scholars express concern over the development. The religious scholars of Cairo, Medina, Istanbul, Qom, and Najaf reacted differently to the occupation. Following these reactions, Arab nations and states described the occupation of Palestine as a national and ethnic issue, leading to the formation of a joint Arab front. In those years, socialist movements in Arab countries united under the Ba'ath Party. However, after successive defeats of the joint Arab front against Israel, the fervor gradually died down and the countries accepted the situation. Under these circumstances, the the scholars of Najaf and Qom had a different reaction to the Zionist occupation. They framed the Palestinian issue as an Islamic one, considering Israel's existence and the continuation of its occupation as opposition to Islam. Among these scholars was Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri, the founder of the Qom Seminary School. Among them, we can mention Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, one of Ayatollah Burujerdi's students, and Sayyid Musa Sadr, one of Allama Tabatabai's students. In the years following the Arabs' defeat by Israel, as many surrendered to Israel in one way or another, the Shia scholars of Najaf and Qom initiated a new movement based on Islamic values, rather than just national, ethnic, or Arab views. Meanwhile, Arab countries, mainly governed by pan-Arab and Ba'athist ideologies, were engulfed in internal strife, pushing the Palestinian issue to the sidelines. In Iran, the Pahlavi regime was closely aligned with Israel, to the extent that Iran was often considered another Israel. However, the people in Iran and Iraq, contrary to their governments, opposed Israel. Amid continued disputes between Mossadegh and the Shah over the closure of the Iranian embassy in Israel, Imam Khomeini began his struggle against the pro-Israel regime. In mid-1953, while many sought an end to the Shah's rule to eliminate foreign influence, for others it marked the beginning of a new movement. When Sayyid Musa Sadr graduated from Tehran University in 1953 with a degree in economics and law, he took a different path, leaving for Lebanon, a region under Israeli control. In the years following the defeat of the United Arab Army in 1948, nationalist socialist movements emerged in regional countries, evolving into powerful forces. New governments under the Ba'ath Party banner took power in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, all united by a common vision to restore Arab dignity. This national, or rather ethnic, pride fostered a collective spirit and determination to stand against Israel. During this period of rising ethnic pride, Sayyid Musa Sadr was actively working in Beirut, Lebanon, addressing the needs of the less privileged areas. Lebanon faced more social disunity compared to other Arab countries due to its religious, intellectual, and ethnic diversity, which prevented the regional fervor from taking root. Through his efforts in meeting various people and offering support, Sayyid Musa Sadr became a unifying figure in Lebanon. He engaged in debates within Lebanese intellectual movements, reaching out to Shia and Sunni religious groups, and supported oppressed communities. While Arab countries had been preparing to confront Israel for years, progress was not as anticipated. Imam Khomeini launched his campaign against the Pahlavi regime in Iran, having warned the Shah on numerous occasions through letters about the detrimental effects of American-Israeli policies. In June 1963, following his efforts to raise awareness through speeches, the Pahlavi regime decided to arrest Imam Khomeini and subsequently exiled him. The Shah believed that Imam Khomeini's movement was confined to Iran's borders and that exile would resolve the issue. However, Imam Khomeini's goal was broader, to awaken the people across the entire region under Shia religious authority. After the people in Arab countries and their military movements felt their national ethnic pride had been awakened, Israel launched a preemptive strike to prevent their forces from integrating. On January 5, 1967, Israel captured the Gaza Strip, the West Bank of the Jordan River, the Sinai Desert, and the Golan Heights in just 6 days. Israel's territory expanded more than threefold in this short period. The Arabs, who had been preparing to confront Israel, were taken by surprise and found themselves in a weak position. Israel continued its advance, reaching within 40 kilometers of Damascus, which would have been a devastating blow to the United Arab Front. In response, Arab nations stood against Israel with all their might to mitigate the defeat. Iraq, coordinating with Egypt, reinforced forces in northern Syria to halt Israel's progress. Israel, having achieved significant success, did not engage in a war of attrition and set conditions for a peace deal that the joint Arab front eventually agreed to under those terms. The defeat in the Six-Day War dealt a harder blow to the Arab nations. A few years passed since that war, and Arab countries decided to retaliate and restore their lost reputation. During those years, the Shah of Iran had been investing a substantial amount of money in Israel's reconstruction. In Israel's most critical situations, the Shah provided a glimmer of hope by supplying the regime with oil. By not supporting the Arab movement, he indirectly strengthened Israel in its fight against the Arab states. Saturday, October 6, 1973. Syria from the north, followed by Egypt from the south, launched surprise attacks on Israel. Initially, the operation favored Syria and Egypt, but gradually, with foreign aid, Israel countered the Egyptian and Syrian armies on two fronts. The Egyptian army was surrounded by the Sinai Desert, and for the first time, Israel entered Egypt's main territory by crossing the west bank of the Nile. In the north, Israel penetrated deep into Syrian territory, with Israeli artillery striking the suburbs of Damascus. After days of intense conflict, on October 25, 1973, the battle finally ended with a UN resolution backed by the United States and the Soviet Union. However, the truce resulted in agreements that brought shame and silence for all Arab countries. During those years, Sayed Musa Sadr had emerged as a prominent leader for the people of Lebanon, earning him the title of Imam Musa Sadr. Imam Musa Sadr began his influential activities soon after arriving in Lebanon. 2 years before the Yom Kippur War, another Iranian, Mostafa Chamran, joined him in Lebanon to help expand his efforts. Chamran, who had studied plasma physics and electromechanics in American universities, was an activist leading student movements in the U.S. against the Shah of Iran. His arrival in Lebanon and meeting with Imam Musa Sadr prompted increasing monitoring by Iran's intelligence and security organization, SABAK, due to his proximity to Israel, the Shah's ally. Dr. Chamran's collaboration with Imam Musa Sadr aimed to organize Lebanese youth, particularly the Shia minority, who were involved in Lebanon's complex and tribal political landscape. With Musa Sadr's presence, they not only maintained structural integrity, but also acted with unity. Under the watchful eyes of SABAK and Mossad, Sadr and Chamran gathered Lebanese Shia youths at Jebel Amel High School, where they provided technical and professional courses. These efforts fostered a strong relationship between the Lebanese youth, Dr. Chamran, and Imam Musa Sadr. The situation in Lebanon, with its predominantly Christian structure, kept the country somewhat distanced from the conflicts between Israel and the Arab nations. However, the presence of displaced Palestinians in Lebanese camps and the establishment of Palestinian resistance forces in Lebanon consistently generated tension in southern Lebanon. Imam Musa Sadr sees this opportunity to teach military principles to members of Amal. Israel posed a direct threat to the Lebanese people. While Lebanese Christian leaders had an unwritten agreement with Israel, the Lebanese Shias were rising from the ashes of Arab pride, not with Arab ideology, but with the concept of Islamic resistance against Israel. After the Camp David Accords and Egypt's withdrawal as one of Israel's most formidable enemies, the path was cleared for Israel to pursue its objectives. One of these goals was to dismantle Palestinian groups dreaming of confronting Israel and liberating Palestine. In the years following the Arab War, Palestinian resistance groups had formed, establishing their headquarters near the Israeli-occupied territories in southern Lebanon, perpetuating regional conflict and tension. A few years after the Yom Kippur War in 1978, and before the victory of the Iranian Revolution, the most serious clashes between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli army began. Lacking substantial power, Palestinian forces were quickly forced out of southern Lebanon by Israel. However, Israel was not satisfied. The mere existence of Palestinian resistance groups meant the Palestinian dream remained alive. To crush that dream, these groups needed to be eliminated, alongside the Israelis searching for their adversaries in Lebanon. The Pahlavi regime was also hunting its opponents in the region. Iran's intelligence and security organization, SAVAK, had a strategic cooperation with Israel's Mossad since its establishment. Training SAVAK forces in Israel by Mossad and exchanging intelligence were key aspects of this cooperation. According to Mossad documents, SAVAK conducted activities abroad to ensure Israel's security and control opposition to the regime in regional countries. These activities included gathering intelligence and espionage in Egypt, Iraq, and Syria. One of the most sensitive countries for both SAVAK and the Mossad was Lebanon. Therefore, SAVAK sought to prevent Lebanon's unification with Egypt, Iraq, and Syria by influencing its ethnic and religious communities, including Christians and Shias, from the early years. SAVAK's mission was to ease Israel's concerns about Lebanon. The relative security of Lebanon had consequences for the Pahlavi regime. The relative peace in Lebanon and the country's non-interference in the Arab alliance against Israel made Lebanon a fertile ground for organizing and equipping Pahlavi opposition groups. Lebanon was a target for both SAVAK and Mossad in a deal where they supported each other. Mossad assisted SAVAK with training, equipment, and intelligence. However, these conditions gradually became more challenging for SAVAK, especially after an Iranian guest, well known by SAVAK forces, and the former head of SAVAK, Taimur Bakhtiar, went to Lebanon. After the coup on August 19, 1952, and the establishment of SAVAK, Taimur Bakhtiar was appointed as its first head. In the early years, organizing Iran's security situation, which still had significant opposition to the Shah and support for Mossadegh, or the Tudeh party, highlighted the importance of Bakhtiar's role in SAVAK. However, the longer Bakhtiar remained in his position, the more he became aware of the Pahlavi regime's corruption. In February 1961, when Bakhtiar was tasked by the Shah to deliver a message to John F. Kennedy, Kennedy's conversation with Bakhtiar about U.S. concerns over the corruption and inefficiency of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's rule angered the Shah. Upset that Kennedy had shared these concerns with Bakhtiar, the Shah removed him from SAVAK within a month. Bakhtiar stayed in Iran for a few months, but his alignment with those opposing the Pahlavi regime was unacceptable to the Shah. Consequently, Bakhtiar was exiled a year later. Exile did not improve the situation. Bakhtiar openly expressed his opposition to the Shah and the ruling regime in West Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. SAVAK reports indicated that Bakhtiar was constantly under surveillance by SAVAK agents, who even accused him of an assassination attempt on the Shah. Additionally, Bakhtiar's frequent trips to Lebanon and his relationship with Imam Musa Sadr were major concerns for the Shah and SAVAK. During those years, Savak and the Shah made several attempts to influence the Amal movement by praising Chamran and Imam Musa Sadr, but these efforts failed. The Shah and Savak were aware of Imam Musa Sadr's influence in Lebanon,